Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, our monthly interview show where we sit down with the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the games industry. I am very pleased to be joined by Brian Fargo, role-playing game legend. I think that's fair to say, don't you?
Yeah, I've been called worse.
You've got a hell of a resume, which we're going to talk all through. I mean, Bard's Tale and Fallout and everything that Interplay ever did, because you founded Interplay, so there was a lot to talk to you about.
Yeah.
I want to start, actually, with a rumor I found about you, which I suspect we'll find out if it's true. Otherwise, I'm going to look real dumb. Is it true that you're part of the Wells Fargo Fargos?
That is way back? That is true. My I think it was my great uncle.
Okay.
Had founded Wells Fargo. It's too bad that it wasn't my grandfather. Otherwise, it might have come right down the chain,
yes.
Right? But, you know, nobody gives their brother's kid all the money in stock, right? So it didn't affect me in that way. But that is true, actually. And I'm actually related to Winston Churchill. One of the Fargos married a Marilla Churchill. She was a Marilla Churchill Fargo, and she was related to Winston. So.
And then do you also have ties to the founding of American Express as well?
Yeah, apparently, was it William Fargo? It was his son that was they sort of helped invent the traveler's check. They were traveling to Europe a lot, and carrying cash became problematic. And so they didn't come up with a credit card, but it was they went from Pony Express, and then it basically the American Express. Traveler's checks.
Yeah.
So it went from traveler's checks to credit cards. That's my understanding. Yeah.
That's so interesting. It's just fascinating family ties there. Go figure.
I get a good treatment when I go to Wells Fargo.
So let's talk games a little bit. You've been in the games industry for quite some time. You've made a hell of a mark. Your parents bought you an Apple II when you were a teenager.
Yeah.
And that was seemingly the catalyst for your career in games. Were they okay with that, or were they hoping you'd become like a mathematician or a financier or something?
No, you know, I'm really fortunate that my parents were supportive of what I was doing. I mean, prior to that, I had the old Magnavox Pong machine and the Atari VCS, and I would go to the arcades religiously, but I had no sense of how these things were made, right? Just none whatsoever. And it was finally when the Apple II. When I asked my parents if they would get me one because I wanted to learn, and you know, thankfully they could A, afford it, and B, they supported it, and that really was like, okay, now I really get it. And so I immediately wanted to be involved with computers. I was programming at the time, but I would have been in any part of the computer business, right? I mean, beyond me to think you could actually make money with games, right? But just to be involved with computers at all. So that was a big moment for me.
That's great that they were supportive and didn't just think of it as a toy. Because certainly back then in the earlier days, I'm sure a lot of parents and would have been even well within their rights to say, oh, that's a waste of time.
Yeah, and it was expensive. I want to say it was over $1,000 for the Apple II and for the hard drive. And boy, if you want another 16K of memory, that's gonna run you some extra too.
What was your favorite game as a kid?
Oh God, on the computer or
anything? What sort of were some of your early favorites?
I played Always a lot crazy. Of Dungeons and Dragons. I mean that was the thing. It was kind of funny because I was athletics were my big passion in high school. I was training for the decathlon.
Oh, wow.
I was one of the fastest guys in the league, and I could do a lot of things. But at the same time, I loved computers and I loved Dungeons & Dragons. So I had a very diverse group of friends, as you might imagine. And so, Dungeons & Dragons certainly was a big influencer on me, a lot of reading too, fiction. And then on computers, it was like today. It's like, you know, I spent a lot of time with well, all games, but virtual reality right now is something, and I just try to get my hands on everything. And so back at the time with on the Apple II, it was the old Sierra games, it was the old Scott Adams text adventures. I remember there was a game called like Computer Bismarck or something. It was a strategy game where you'd make a move and the computer would like take like 2 hours for it to make its turn, and you'd come back and hope that it didn't crash. And so, you know, I played everything I'd get my hands on.
Now, Fergus Urquhart was in here doing this show, and he said the same thing. He was a big pen and paper D&D guy as a kid.
Yeah.
Does that, and do you figure that's probably not a coincidence that you ended up heavily involved in computer role-playing games after being a D&D guy?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, because that was where we got all of our great thrill, and we'd stay up all hours of the night playing this thing, and of course there was the social part of it, but there was also the rules, and I always found the rules fascinating, and in part, I always thought law would be interesting too, because I always felt like we were always like pulling the spell book out and say, well, you know, I have a 20-foot cone of silence, yes, but I casted this spell to overcome it. And we're like, you know, like legal scholars looking through, you know, trying to figure out whether it was appropriate what was going on, so I always got a kick out of that.
Tell me about your first game, which, if I have it right, is called Labyrinth of Mardigan.
Right. Well, it was called you're right, Labyrinth of Mardigan. That is correct. That was something I did in high school with Michael Cranford, who ended up working with me on The Bard's Tale.
So tell me about the game. What was it about? What was the
so,
play?
Well, that one was kind of funny. So it was all in BASIC. It was all we really understood. And what that was is I'd make this room, this kind of simple puzzle room, where I think it was just a series of choices of, you know, 1, 2, or 3 or yes or no, and then you'd have to figure out how to get out of the room. Well, Michael, his parents didn't buy him a computer, so I would give him the computer and he'd take it home for days and he'd do his room. Right, and then he'd bring it back, and I'd try to solve his. And we went back and forth all summer, and we put all the rooms together and put it into a packaging, and I just sold a few here and there.
How cool is that?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Cool. So did you even intend for it to turn into a product that you would do something with, or was that just sort of an organic of you guys going back and forth?
It was really just the organic going back and forth. You know, that I thought, well, let's try to mix the two together, and it was a mishmash of stuff. But it was... it was good because I think it taught me how to finish something, right?
Yeah.
Which is always, I always say, starting games is easy and finishing them is hard, and so I think there's some good things that came out of it.
There's always feature creep can always get in the way, right? You can always want to add one more thing.
Yeah, and just getting all the bugs out and everything else. Yeah.
Do you ever fire up that first game from time to time? Do you still have it?
I have the packaging. I'd have to find an old Apple II and get it to run. I don't know that I have the code for that, but I'm pretty sure I bet I'm the only one in the world with the packaging. I mean, it's pretty rare.
Well, if anybody should have it, it should probably be
me.
You.
Well, you'd think so. There's so many games at Interplay that I don't know why I didn't take a crate home every time we ship a game and just put it in storage. So I found myself scrambling to get copies of things later.
Well, right before you started Interplay, you were making educational games for the World Book Encyclopedia.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
What were you doing? What were those?
So what that was about was I don't remember how I got... So I was at a company called Boone Corporation. It was all Stanford graduates, and they wanted to get in the software business. And they had money, but they really didn't know what to do. So I was the vice president, and I was running the company, the product side of the company. And that's a whole story into itself, right? And so that company started to implode with lots of infighting and things like that, and fist fights. I mean, it's like crazy stuff, yeah. And I thought, well, this is how corporate America works, right? And so it was sort of time to do my own thing. And I had met somebody who worked for a professor at UCI. He says, you know how to do software. We're getting a contract from World Book Encyclopedia because we're going to sell the Peanut, which is a PC Junior, door-to-door with educational software. We need somebody to do the work. And it was a $120,000 contract.
Wow.
Well, you can imagine, I'm 20 years old. Yeah. I mean, and it was a long time
early
ago.
Early 80s, maybe?
Yeah, so that's like a fortune. And they said, we'll give you a third, and you do the work. And I said, well, you know, how about half? You know, I am going to do all of the work. And so that's what we did. And so that $60,000 was the seed money to start Interplay.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Now
I have that packaging too.
good. In fact, that actually, I'm going to move ahead because this. You mentioned talking about fist fights in the studio. Richard Garriott was in here recently as well.
Yeah.
I don't mean to keep name dropping.
Yeah, no.
Other RPG guys.
I never got in a fight with him.
But Yeah, so he was in here, and he told me, this was fascinating, I read his book, I don't know if you've had a chance to see it yet. He told me that he saw a whole lot of drug use when he got out to California among game developers during that time, that sort of early 80s time frame. Did you see anything like that going on?
No, I heard about it, and I probably know what companies he's talking about too. but not down where we were. I mean, listen. When I started my company, I actually had to have my employees. I wasn't old enough to buy a beer, right? And so that was about the extent of the drugs that we had.
So we're going to talk obviously a lot of RPGs with you. What is it about the role playing game genre that draws you to it?
Well, I mean, certainly there's a kind of an emotional passion side to it in that I grew up playing them, and it was a big part of who I was as a kid. And then with that, I love pushing the art of something, right? I mean, I obviously have to wear a business hat when I come to this because sure. If I don't, I'm not going to stay in business. But I like pushing the craft of what it is. So whether it was, barge sale going like, a lot of barge sale was driven by the fact that at the time you could only do one thing at a time at a computer, like you do one single thing. So the big breakthrough with Bard Cell is you could play music at the same time and keep the game, not freeze the whole game up.
Yeah.
That was like a huge deal, right? And so, the idea of incorporating music and color graphics and that sort of thing in a genre was something that I thought was pushing the envelope. And then Wasteland with the more open world nature of it. So it's driven very much by passion and craft, I think.
So you started Interplay at 20. If I have it right here,
and
I'm guessing that again, given your family background, that your family was very supportive of your entrepreneurial efforts.
They've always been great. I mean, I give them a lot of credit. So for whatever I was doing, they were very supportive with my endeavors and anything they could do to help. They didn't really know what I was doing at that point, right? But they thought it was good. So yeah.
So. And then at first, you were a for-hire development house, Interplay.
That's right.
What made you change to wanting to publish games as well?
Yeah, so at the time, a lot of the games that were being made that were successful were made by very small teams. It was Dr. J and Larry Bird Go One-on-One, or Bill Budge's Pinball Construction Set, or even Aclabath and Ultima series, mostly by Richard doing a lot of the heavy lifting. So whereas I wanted to do sort of games with more talents coming into it than just two people. Wanted somebody to answer the phones rather than us, right? Wanted to have an office building. Wanted to have like a real company. And we did the Bard's Tale, right? And we made number one, and we were just making a little bit of money.
Yeah.
And then we do Bard's Tale 2, another number one hit. We're making a little bit of money. So I remember the time I went to Electronic Arts and said, hey, this is as good as it gets. We were like over 10% of their business or something. It was a big piece at the time. And I said, I got to improve the deal. Otherwise, what's the point? And I said, can we get our royalty to like 20% from 15%? They're like, absolutely not, right? So I said, okay, all right, well, then I'll just, the only way to do it is to start financing it myself so I can get a bigger piece of the pie. And so that's what drove me towards being a publisher, was just so for survival more than anything.
Well, and maybe EA probably, maybe they rue that day. They could have had a better business relationship with you.
Yeah, all things are meant to be sometimes, right?
So... ton of great RPGs at Interplay over the years. Bard's Tale, Wasteland, Fallout. Do you have a favorite kid amongst all the games over the years at Interplay?
Of a role playing game or just in general or
in general, yeah.
Yeah.
Any that really stuck out to you over the years that just are really extra near and dear to you?
God. It's so hard for me to pick one, only because there were pivot points at Interplay where if not for that game we would have gone out of business.
Yeah.
Right. And so I can't help but pick those, right?
Makes sense.
I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Bard's Tale, right? And then when we Castles, there was Battle Chess, we were the first affiliate publisher, right? So we bet the farm on Battle Chess, right? And it worked, and we moved to the next level. And then we had to break away from Activision, a different Activision than today. They were going bankrupt. They were my distributor, and so I had to pull off, and I had to go direct to all of the retailers. And that was a nightmare because I had to take back returns from products I'd never got paid for to begin with. So if castles didn't work, we were out of business.
Wow.
And so there's been a series of those along the way. I think I remember we did a game with Blizzard. It was RPM Racing.
Yeah.
And it was...
Yeah, I was going to ask you that next.
Yeah, so I actually had to borrow money from my wife's father just to buy, because the units were like $20 a piece, right? So if I want another... 5,000 pieces. That's $100,000 right now. We have no money, so we bet the farm on that, you know. And so, to me, it was all those seminal titles that made a big deal. I mean, Fallout certainly is my biggest impact on pop culture, and it's my people don't know what I do. I bring that one up, and they go, "Oh yeah," you know. So you can't help but pick that one. But there were just so many important games that were critical for our survival that I would be. It wouldn't feel right by not putting them on the list. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you just sort of touched on it. You were sort of in a way involved with the founding of Blizzard with RPM Racing. Boy, I foolishly didn't write that. I forget their name at the time.
Silicon and Blizzard. Synapse.
Yes,
right,
thank you.
Right.
So yeah, how do you end up meeting up with those guys and working on doing the game together?
Well, so I knew them. I mean, at the time, of course, there was no internet, and so we were kids basically, and we would get a game and we would trade software, right? I mean, that was the thing back then. You didn't even. The store had very few things. We make copies, right, which you can't do today, or weren't supposed to do anyway. But we were, you know, that's how I knew those guys. And later, Alan went into the military, and Interplay kept going. He got back, and he said, "I want to do what you're doing. That looks great." And I said, "Well, let me help you." And so we gave them their first contracts to get them launched into the business.
Wow. That's a nice notch on your belt, right? Yeah, I helped. I helped kickstart Blizzard in a way.
Well, you know, and I actually own 10% of Blizzard, right? And people go, "Oh, can't believe you sold it," right? But in fairness, there's things called drag along rights, and so when they wanted to sell their company to Davidson, I got dragged along with it. Even though I wouldn't have stopped it anyway, I wouldn't have said, "I'm going to hang on and mess up the deal," right? Yeah. I would never do that. So, but you know, imagine if they said, "No, please keep it." It, you know, wow.
Okay, yeah.
but it wasn't an option of mine. But yeah, no, they were. I always I like to think I have a good eye for talent, right?
What you're known for.
Part of my job is to know a good idea when I hear it, and know good talent when I meet them.
You're credited on a bunch of other fascinating games over the years. I want to throw some out, and just if you have an anecdote or memory,
okay,
feel free to share, because there are some even here I didn't know. Like I knew, you know, I was big PC gamer in the '90s and was familiar with a lot of these, but you actually got to work with Nintendo. Mario Teaches Typing.
Yeah. So I got a funny story with that one. So at the time. Mavis Beacon Teaches Typing was the big hit.
Big one.
Right, and I knew Les Crane was Software Toolworks, and so I had seen somewhere that like over half the people were buying it to teach their kid how to type. So I thought, well, God, you know, a teacher, you know, what's more interesting than a teacher but Mario, right? So
sure.
I went to Nintendo, and I pitched them, and they loved it. So we put Mario Brothers out, and it's a huge success, right? And then he got so angry with me. I actually went to his show, and he was giving me like this stink eye, you know. And my wife goes, "Well, that guy really doesn't like you," you know. And I go, "Well, oh my gosh," you know. So I call him up, and I'm like, "Did I do something?" He goes, "No." I said, "Really? No?" He goes, "No." I said, "Well, can I send the tone of your voice?" You know. He goes, "Well, yeah." And I go, "Well, you know, you're competing with me." I said, "Oh, come on, you know, you're competing with other people," right? Anyway, he was so mad at me. Anyway, we made up for it later, but kind of funny.
Because, I feel like Nintendo they don't really do that stuff anymore. I guess they were...
Well, actually, we did Mario Teaches Typing, then we did Mario's Game Gallery. Miyamoto, he liked what we were doing, right? Mm-hmm. And so everybody was happy, and then somebody else came out with some other Mario product that was not high quality. And so they came back and said, "No more with Mario." And we said, "Yeah, but you like us." He said, "Brian, we do, but he says, "No more." That's
somebody
it.
Else ruined it. They ruined it.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
The gravy train comes to
I know,
end.
I know. That was a big success for us, Mario Teaches Typing.
How about, because this one, I always remember this and just laugh because it was sort of a humorous game, Clay Fighter.
Yeah. That was a game that was pitched to us by Visual Concepts, and they were doing some great work. And Yeah, that was a big success, and we had a couple things with it. One is, I remember we got Bruce Buffer, right? So, you know, instead of let's get ready to rumble, he says let's get ready to crumble, right? And so that was always kind of a crack up. And then we did well with that. I remember Blockbuster. We did a special version for Blockbuster. It was like a limited edition, just to rent, for Blockbuster, and we made like $1 million on that deal.
Wow.
And that probably made our entire year. And that's what they're good.
There go the questions.
Yeah, that's one thing you'll find in business. You'll do 100 things in business, and then you'll get to the end of the year, and you're like, if we hadn't done that one thing, it wouldn't have been a profitable year. That's why you got to do the 100 or the 101 or whatever. It all comes down to one or two things that makes the difference.
And yeah, Clay Fighter was sort of this almost parody of the fighting game genre, which was huge at that time.
Yeah,
Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat.
But yeah, yeah.
It was good. People liked it.
They really did. Had a lot of personality.
And then this one's very near and dear to my heart.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit 1 million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit 1 million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
I just remember this game so fondly, Out of This World.
Oh, yeah, Eric Shahi. That was so back in the day. One of the things I used to do, which I loved in my business, and it finally stopped, was I would go over to Europe for the trade shows like ECTS, and it'd be like, you know, like an E3, and there'd be booths up and down the thing, and I would try to find product that I thought could work in America.
Smart,
right?
That's smart.
And I had plenty of competition, but it was whether I had a better eye, mm-hmm. and I could negotiate getting it. And so it was Delphine Software, and I loved the work they were doing.
Yeah.
So that's where I got out of this world or another world. And then Alone in the Dark was the same thing, right? And then I did work with Gremlin Software, and so I was always sort of sourcing. Eventually, those companies started to set up shop in America.
Figure it out themselves.
And I couldn't get the rights. But it was sort of as an intellectual exercise. It was fun to just, because remember, there were hundreds of games.
Sure.
So you got to find just the right one and figure out how to make it work.
Find all those needles in the haystack.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed that.
So by the mid-90s, Interplay was up to over 600 people at the company, which that's a lot for a AAA game studio now, let alone back then.
Yeah.
Was that too much too fast in hindsight, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, we were in some ways, we were a victim of our own success, and I'll tell you why I say that. So we did RPM Racing, and it did great, right?
Yeah.
So okay, let's do more of that. I did a pool game, Virtual Pool. It sold 300,000 or 400,000 pieces.
I remember that.
Let's do sports, right? We did Mario Teaches Typing, sells 700,000. Let's do educational software, right? And so we had hit in every single category. We had role playing. Let's do more of that. So we took all of our strengths. Now at the same time, Universal Studios had come in and invested into the company. And they'd put $10 million in, which sounds like a lot of money, but except in the games business, that goes quickly, right? And they said, let's build this thing up. So it's kind of a perfect storm, right? And we had all this success, they threw in the money, and then everything didn't work in every category, right? It was like we had like every single thing stopped working. And then we also had deals in Japan with Matsushita, and they didn't come through on their side. It was just like everything at once. And so, yeah, it was a miserable time. But you know, we did at least. I'm very proud that because we've always had more financial pressure than most, and we've usually had less resources than most. But yet, when I look at the '90s and what we did at Interplay, we were putting out some great stuff despite all those pressures. It was Baldur's Gate, Fallout, Planescape Torment, Descent. You name it, right? I mean, there was a lot of maybe not Descent was early. We didn't have so much financial pressure at that point. But later on, anything from kind of '95 on, we had guns at our head, but we were staying, you know, true to the quality of the company. But certainly, we were too big. Yeah.
So tell me about your memories of the origin of Black Isle, because it of course, the legendary role-playing studio, it formed within Interplay.
Right. So that came about because we were doing lots of different kinds of products, right? We were doing strategy games. We had a game called Max. We were doing adventure games, like I said, action games, role-playing games. So I said, well, most of the companies that have a brand associated with themselves, they do one kind of thing, generally speaking. Then you're like, you know, EA Sports, we know they do great sports, right? And so I felt like that we were getting diluted in what does Interplay represent? So I didn't want to represent nothing. And so the idea was, okay, let's divisionalize these groups. Okay, Fergus, you know, you're going to run the RPG group. And I think Fallout had already shipped when Black Isle got formed, even though it was a lot of the guys were in Black Isle. They came up with the name, and he ran the group, and off they went. And each group did their thing, and then it was, in a way, survival of the fittest as to who could make their groups work.
Did you know that the Black Isle group was something special, that they were the best of the best?
Yeah, I mean, they were always super. I mean, that was our bread and butter, role-playing games. But yeah, we had honed ourselves for many years, and we had the right sensibilities. So when we, with a lot of this stuff, if you're going to be in a category, you need to be talking about it 24 hours a day, right? You know, what other people are doing, what innovations are happening, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was a big part of it. And of course, we gave BioWare their first break too, right?
With Shattered Steel,
and which was not a success. But we thought, well, you know, these guys are talented. Let's give them another try with Baldur's Gate. And I got into the Dungeons & Dragons license, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which at the time I was told was a horrible idea. I remember one of the leading publishers says, you know, Brian, you're nicheware for nerds. That's all you do, you know. And I said, well, you know, for us, getting D&D was like a big deal.
Sure.
And of course, you know, it worked out great. So that's kind of how it all came about.
So when Black Isle wanted to do Fallout, which was inspired by your game, Wasteland, which is very revered, what did you think when Fallout gets pitched to you?
Well, post-apocalyptic has always been my favorite category in terms of film and books, right? And so whether it was, you know, references of Mad Max or Swan Song or Canticle for Leibowitz or, you know, you choose it. So I've always been drawn to that. And so we I had tried to get the rights to Wasteland back from EA for year after year after year. So I finally gave up, threw in the towel, and said, let's just do one ourselves.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's how Fallout was born.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah. And then we studied the sensibilities of Wasteland. What made that work? Like the open nature of it, you know, the skill-based system, blah, 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 blah. Right? So that we sort of analyzed all the things that we thought worked. And there's also a lot of things where the names are very similar, too, as you go from Wasteland to Fallout. So,
and I imagine that... You were very personally involved with Fallout. I imagine that was a pretty personal project for you, given
It was, though I will say, and it was for sure. But then, you know, what I try to do is I try to get the groups. I try to bring lots of talented people together, best of breed. I'm like an orchestra pit, right? And it gets to a point where a game sort of starts moving on itself and becomes this organic thing, like magic. And those guys started firing on all cylinders, and they started doing things that I wasn't involved with, which was great, right? So I would fight for things that I knew were right, you know. So when they started going with the 50s, kind of the innocence of the 50s mixed with the violence, I went, brilliant, right? I mean, yeah. You know, so they kind of ran with it and made it bigger. You know, I think all these games are about making something bigger than any one person could ever do. And how can you facilitate that kind of environment and allow that to happen?
So is it fair to say that you left Interplay over a power struggle?
Well, I think it depends on the definition, but maybe I should just tell the story, and then you can use whatever words you think. So we did. Titus came in the company. We'd gone public. The public market kind of depressed. It left us in a vulnerable position. They were going to come in and shore up our financing, and so that wasn't a healthy relationship. And then at one point, I had a buyer for the company, and they had traded their negotiation, which turned off the buyer. And I was sort of scrambling for many, many years, just trying to shore us back up financially. And I got very, very close. We had like $50 million of debt at one point, and I'd worked it down to five.
Wow.
And then I had somebody coming in that was going to like take out the five, put money in the bank. And I was like, I can get back to doing what I do.
Sure.
And they said, yeah, you know, we kind of might want to do a hostile takeover. Well, so after, you know, what I thought I was a pretty incredible effort, I thought, oh, you know what, I'm going to have a heart attack, right? I mean, this is, you know, and I had very small share of the company at that point. So I just said, look, I'm not going to fight about this. You go for it. I got to do something else. And so so however you want to categorize that's what happened.
Did it kill you to walk away from the company you'd built?
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, it was who I was, right? I mean, I was identified with it, and then of course you got to see later, like, who's returning my phone calls now? You know, I was like, oh, he's not in a power seat. Well, now what? Right. So that was kind of interesting to see what happened there. But yeah, no, it was definitely tough, and I loved my people, I loved the product, and you know, and I felt like it was, you know, not at the best of hands, but I couldn't do it. And I take responsibility for all the bad decisions that got us there, too. It's not like everybody else's fault.
Right.
Business is tough. I mean, we're in the entertainment business fundamentally. And a lot of the companies, we didn't have that seminal hit, that Grand Theft Auto, that Tony Hawk, the THQ wrestling, yeah. that thing that could just ride you through the hard times. And you look at a lot of entertainment businesses, like Universal had it with the monster films, like in the 30s or 40s,
sure.
Right? What was that thing? And Baldur's Gate was big for us, but we had a big, heavy royalty load to BioWare and TSR. Mm. So if it, not for that, those two things, of course, it wouldn't have existed without them. But that aside, financially speaking, if we didn't have that, we would have been in a far different position. So we didn't have that one title that was sort of that was controlled.
That you could rely on to go back to the well.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So
do you actively, are you rooting against Interplay? Are you kind of rooting for them to fail after that, or is there a part of you where, you know, because you built it, you still have a soft spot for them in your heart?
I would never root against my people not having jobs, right? So no. I mean, to me, you sort of get yourself back up, you know, and dust yourself off, and you move on to something else. It's positive. So no, I never rooted against them in that way.
And that something else is InXile, which you founded in 2002.
That's right. That's right.
I suppose the name has a very personal touch on that.
Well, so that came about. You know, we were going to the trade show in 2002, or I think it's 2002, and I couldn't get a business card unless I had a name of a company.
Yeah.
And so we're like, okay, came up with The Workshop. That was the name of the company. just made one up so we could print it up. And they said, well, what do you want for your title to be? And I went, oh, leader in exile, right? Just as a joke. And so I went to them handing out the cards. And then at the show, people started coming up to me going, oh, I heard about your card. Let me get one. And so after had two or three people sort of proactively hunt me down to get one of these cards, I thought, well, maybe we're onto something here. And that's how the name came about.
That's a cool story.
Yeah.
How fun was it for you to bring back the Bard's Tale in 04 on the PS2, original Xbox, PC?
Well, I had a blast making that game. And I mean, that was, you know, as you know, we took a very different turn on that, right? So I didn't have the copyright to use for the Bard's Tale, but I liked the character, and we wanted to do something like we liked the stuff that Snowblind was doing with their engine,
yeah,
right?
Top down action.
Yeah,
RPG,
like the Dark Alliance, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of liked what was being done with Dark Alliance and financing there. It had to be console if I was going to get any financing at all. So more action of oriented bent, but I didn't want to do a straight up Dark Alliance. I wanted to give our taste of humor with it. And so I still sometimes I'll watch YouTube videos of some places in Bard's Tale that I've forgotten about, and it's just so funny. I just some of the stuff in there is just so clever and witty. I love it.
You set the Kickstarter record for fastest project to $1 million.
Yeah.
With Torment, which Tides of Numenera, which as we record, yeah, just released. How was the experience of not having to answer to any corporate overlord or any person upstairs that was telling you to do stuff?
Well, I think as a creative person, there's two important factors to me, right? Is that you're doing what you want to do, right? Which is that's one part that's not easier said than done.
Sure.
But as important is that you're doing it the way you want to do it, right? Because you could be working on it, but be made to do it in a way that isn't with your style. And so that was the best part. So for me, with both those projects, we were actually having fun making games again, and we could be nimble and making adjustments of something that felt right or didn't feel right without fear of not being paid, right? So, I mean, because it's the ultimate honor system, right, which is our backers are like, here you go make the game, please deliver, don't let us down. And so, you know, we like that, and we, you know, now we're two for two. We've come up with a good quality product, so, you know, keep it going.
Yeah, Wasteland 2 was actually before that. That game turned out absolutely great.
Yeah.
How did it feel to get that back and bring that back?
Well, that one was also especially nice. I mean, kind of the serendipity of the things that put me on the map were Bard's Tale and Wasteland. And here I am back with Bard's Tale and Wasteland, right? So I like that. And EA was great. I mean, you know, people give EA a hard time, but you know what? They're a great company to deal with. They're very professional. And they're like, yeah, we're not going to use it. And I strike a deal to use the copyright. And that what has allowed me to do a proper Wasteland sequel and now a proper Bard's Tale sequel too. So that was a lot of fun. And then kind of as we sat and going over all the material and, oh, yeah, you know, remembering the little nuances of it all. And we put a lot of things in Wasteland 2 where if, like, you don't have to play the first one, but if you did, there's some great little Easter eggs and little inside jokes that are very funny.
Well, you mentioned bringing those back, but now we've got Wasteland 3 also.
Yeah, we're just warming up.
Yeah, what can you tell us about Wasteland 3?
Well, so very happy with the way Wasteland 2 came out, but we had to invent a lot of systems and how things were going to work. And so now we're like, okay, we know what things really felt good and things that didn't. And now we're able to start building upon something and not, because Wasteland 2 was really starting from scratch. You couldn't build off of Wasteland 1. It was a different
25
world.
25 years ago.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So that, not as useful. This is really useful. So now we're able to focus even more so on the writing and on the nuances and on the animation. And the thing that I'm most excited about with that, other than just sort of like, we want to be the best post-apocalyptic RPG, no doubt about it. And we're, like I said, I got the whole writing team from Torment, and some of those guys worked out on Fallout New Vegas. And so we got a great group. But also multiplayer, which I think is fascinating. That, and again, single-player narrative experience, you won't even know multiplayer is there, so don't worry about it. Yeah. But we get that, right? But there is a time, you know, and Divinity Original Sin shows that it can be fun to play with your friend. But I really want to focus on what it means to play with your friend, not like, okay, you attack, I attack, or, you know, I have the key and you have the lock, and we, you know, but like from a narrative perspective. And so that's something where I want to push the craft of what that means to have a multiplayer narrative game.
You're speaking my language. I like that.
Yeah.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, what do you think of Bethesda's fallouts, with them picking up the torch?
Yeah, well, I mean, brilliant what they've done with it, right? I mean, they've made it one of the biggest franchises in the world. I think going first or third person brings an immersion that you don't get with isometric, so I got to recognize that. That's why in Wasteland 3, for example, bringing the camera down for conversations, when you're having a conversation with a character and you're looking at him and he's talking to you and you're hearing the audio, it puts you more in the scene. So even when the camera comes out, that little guy is much more alive than had you not seen
him.
Right. So I like that part of it, but we don't want to give up the tactical side. Bethesda certainly notes that as they know from the immersion. And then they did a more of an open world, of course, right? You know, the kind of the freedom for what the player can do. You know, that was to me like the biggest innovation. So, you know, I think they've done a fine job with the franchise.
So, last question I've got to ask. I'm curious, you know, you've just made so many great role-playing games, so many great games over the years. What do you think of the RPG genre as a whole now, and where do you think it's heading in the next half decade or 10 years?
Boy, it's so hard because I think in more incremental steps, right? Like I could say, okay, I want to work on multiplayer narrative and what that means. You know, and then when I get done with that, there'll be something that dawns on me. It's hard for me to jump ahead 10 or 20 years in that regard. I think the openness of the worlds is not going to go away. People like that freedom. I mean, the thing that makes a role-playing game good to me, and I think to most people, is that I play it the way I want, and then it pays off when you do those things, right? And so a lot of times in narrative games, they don't pay them off enough because it's difficult to pay off nuances of your decisions. It's easy to say, you know, you need 9 pelts and you don't have them and you don't get the thing, right? I mean, but there's a payoff when you get them. That's a whole different vibe. But, you know, I have to say that virtual reality is, I mean, I'm not saying because we're working on a role-playing game in VR, but we're talking about immersion and how powerful it is from a camera perspective. Well, now if I'm walking around in the world, that changes everything. And so I think that clearly that's where it's going to be going. And some people say, I don't know if I want to spend 10 hours in a game like that. But as the fidelity comes down, and you know, I think it's inevitable that this is kind of where we're going.
Well, Brian Fargo, thank you so much. It was a pleasure learning more about your career. Wasteland, Fallout, Bard's Tale, all these games. Mario teaches typing.
Yeah,
Clay,
yeah,
you name
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Everything Interplay was such a wonderful publisher for so many years. Appreciate having you on, Brian. And for much more on the best minds in the video game industry, be sure to keep it tuned right here every week for new segments and every month for new episodes of IGN Unfiltered.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the spirit?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
To save yourself.
Of course. What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.